There is, of course, a very important thing for parliamentary committees, which is a standing document from the Treasury as to how oversight should take place. I commend that document to you, right? Because we can't go into it. It's very embarrassing for you to say whether the oversight is satisfactory or not. Right? Now, some commissions would prefer no oversight should take place. And they're very happy with that. So we won't ask you, are you happy with the portfolio committee? That's not a fair question. But I must ask you this. Now, before we went broke over, why do you have internal systems apart from the performance? And so how do you deal with differences of opinion or real differences between commissioners and commissioners' staff? And can you answer this? The chief executive is not automatically a member of the commission. He's not a member of the commission.
Yes, the chief executive is not a member of the commission, but in terms of the ICASA Act, she or he is appointed by council to assist it in the execution of its task with regard to the mandate and other staff as well.
One problem is that the fact that she's not a member, as they are in other commissions, explains some of the difficulties you're having in your country, historically.
We have what is known as the PFMA, the Performance Management Act, and that the sole custodian of the PFMA is the Chief Executive Officer. But the CAS Amendment Act says she will operate under our supervision and control to do administrative tasks. So you have this independence with regard to PFMA, but we also have to have direct responsibility and accountability. And that in itself creates probably a two-headed hydra, where it's a where the CEO would say, I'm responsible for the running of this organization. But then we would say, in terms of the ICASA Act, you are supposed to do this under our supervision and control, and we have to have oversight, because finally when...
That's what I'm asking you a question. What's the answer?
How do you resolve that? I think that there has to be a legal for the Amendment Act in the case of it. Because it creates a two-headed hierarchy. The PFMA and the CAS Amendment Act. The PFMA allows the CEO
to be the sole custodian in terms of the finances and the administration of the organization. But at the same time, that CEO is accountable and she has to operate under our supervision and control. In other words, we have to have oversight. And sometimes it so happens that it's only after the fact, when some certain things have gone wrong, that they come to the fore. Because oversight is really a matter of light touch.
The PFMA applies to government departments. The accounting officer is the Director General. But you know, the minister can give directions to the Director General, which the PFMA allows. The minister can give instructions to the executive general. You don't need an amendment. I have it on. You don't need an amendment to the PFMA to have a proper rational arrangement. If you're waiting for an amendment, you're going to wait for a long time. So what I'm trying to say here is kind of institutional, what we want to know, and sometimes this work of the committee helps you. Can you work out institutional arrangements? Not a memorandum of understanding, an institutional arrangement. But accountability can work both ways, right? She's answerable or he's answerable to the commission. The commission itself recognizes that day-to-day administration is in our hands. Now, that's what we're trying to do, right? without going into specific details. The other issue I must ask you is that do you think that having all commissioners full-time people has not resulted in some people who would like to serve on it, particularly those who have technical capacity, who would like to serve on a part-time basis? Again, some commentator says to me that this militates against getting the kind of expertise of the council board. Now, again, it's a tough question, but if you want to have that, worldly-wise relationship between the chief executive and the commission, it might be useful to have some part-time members of the commission. Again, it's to deal with the efficiency of the body. Do you have any comments on that?
If I could just allow Councillor Machiza maybe to help with coming up with a response to this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think we tried really in terms of our submissions to the ECA to have a reduced number of councillors, and rather instead of having a heavy top structure, you actually had far more resourced, the executive management to deal with that level. But those were the submissions that we made, having benchmarks, according in terms of the Ofcom and the FCC and Malaysian models. So we were not really successful in that event.
My final question is,
it has been suggested that there's been a blurring of the distinction between the councillors' work and the full-time staff. Councillors have been accused of interfering in the day-to-day operation of the institution, undermining the chief executive officer, undermining the full-time staff. On the other hand, the full-time staff may not have always had the qualifications, so that councillors themselves had to intervene. You would agree that there has been some validity in the argument that councillors have been, as it were, running the administration. Would you agree with that?
I think I would more or less preface this by saying the Act itself says we have, as councillors, the responsibility for running the organization. That's what the Act is saying. And we shall appoint the CEO to assist us in running the organization on administrative matters, but on licensing and regulation, the remit is with us. But in the final analysis, if anything goes wrong by way of finances, etc., we will be accountable, even though the administrative part of it is handled at the CEO level. So we are faced with this difficult situation. Where should we be off hands? And when are we going to say we have to answer to Parliament if anything went wrong in terms of financial administration and all other things that can result in impropriety? So much as we would not want to, but if anything goes wrong, we would be then asked, how come you were not aware? Now the question is, how deep should we go to China? Should we look over people's shoulders? Maybe that would not be, we would then be sort of be seen as really micromanaging. So we are faced with that difficulty as to when are we going to say we are accountable and when are we going to say so-and-so is accountable.
We have to look at the efficacy. That's what the term of reference says. The efficiency and efficacy, it says. Is it working? Efficiency is the quality. Efficacy is the actual structure. It seems to us that you haven't worked out whatever the law may say, and I'm a lawyer too, you haven't worked out a day-to-day system of relationship between the commissioners and the staff. How do you explain, if you're on what you said, that you suspended your chief executive for 10 months and didn't bring a charge? Now, what kind of system is that? Now, that's an effective thing about efficacy. 10 months somebody suspended, didn't bring a charge, person allowed to resign, she got some kind of handshake, I understand, right? Or some kind of benefit. What kind of structure was it that in 10 months there was never a proper investigation then?
Let me phrase it this way. We were made aware of certain infections. And quickly we wanted to conduct an investigation because that was prima facie. And then, of course, we conducted an investigation. We solidified those charges. But in the process during suspension, there were other charges that came forth that unfolded while she was serving suspension. And we brought forth those as well. And the processes were said that the representatives, in terms of the case, could not find common periods within which to arrange suitable dates to have this matter resolved. By June, we had already formulated, I think, six charges of some sort. Initially, there were two. But during the suspension, other issues came to the fore. And then there was a question of dates. Who is available, when, etc. Our representative on one side and her representative on the other. And those dates were clashing. And that in itself, of course, is we have to respect processes. We then have to observe that things have got to take their normal course. Inasmuch as I wanted this case to be resolved at the soonest possible means and times, the unavailability of people at the same city created difficulties. Finally, the CEO offered to resign, to terminate the contract, and then serve her 3 months' notice. She wanted to get on with her life. And then we say, okay, you shall resign, and in lieu of you serving the 3 months' notice, we'll pay you the 3 months. So there was no other extra fees that could have been conceived of. Initially, let me point out, she had offered to resign that we pay her legal costs. And we said, no. We don't see any reason why that should be the case. If you choose to resign, resign. And then she came back and said, okay, in this particular respect, I am resigning, and I'll henceforth serve notice. So we said, okay, we want to quickly stabilize the organization. The notice was a 3 months notice that she needed to serve. So we decided then, okay, to then agree at that point in time for her to terminate.
Thank you. We won't pursue this very much further, but in many other countries, where there's a serious charge, there's a suspension without pay. They're very, very serious charges. Right? If they're less serious charges, there's a suspension of pay and absence from office. But it does take, you know, because lay people treat lawyers as become slightly below the grade of second-hand McCarthy. And sometimes lawyers will say, for lay people to take 10 months and not to have a hearing seems beyond the realms of understanding, frankly. Right? Really, if there were charges in the day, charge them. Don't find new charges afterwards. That's irrelevant. So did you have sufficient weighty charge to suspend them in the first place? If you didn't, you shouldn't have suspended them. All they're concerned with is if an organization of such enormous importance cannot operate without a chief executive officer for 10 months. That's all they're concerned about. Other issues about whether it's compensated or not irrelevant. So we'll note that it was not possible for you to have a hearing and determine the charge within the 10 months.
No, with respect, I'd like to say we had two charges initially which we investigated, and in the process other charges emerged. For instance, if an issue is brought to the chairperson, so we have identified that there was this impropriety. What could happen is that, okay, we add it on, or we say, let this one go through, but there will be an additional one. So we thought, in one fell swoop, let us bring them all on board, because that charge will not be in suspension. It will still have to come forth. And when, as chairperson, you are faced with a situation of saying, there is a charge, it becomes difficult for me to say, no, forget about this one. We have those in place. Because it will mean that at one stage we've charged her, and then suddenly we realize that we needed to charge her further. We come back and say,
the suit wasn't one fell. It took a long time for the suit. So we won't go into that. But shouldn't this be a board decision, also a commission decision? It's very important. Should it be a decision by a chairperson only as to whether it should be cumulative charges or individual charges? Or have you say you came to know something happened? But shouldn't this be a decision of the commission as to?
We have records to indicate that this was a decision of commission. I was just there indicating in my capacity of the head of the decision, but it was a board decision.
Thank you. We exhausted that. Yes, Mrs. Bonsman.
The Chair, in my view, we have not exhausted it, and I'd like to ask some further questions.
Yeah.
The absence of the CEO has been a very material factor in the poor performance of ICASA financially. If you look at the Auditor General's report, time and again you will find that that deficit you ran up of $33 million is ascribable to the absence of the CEO and CFO as it happened. That some of the procurement irregularities are ascribable to that. The fact that staff were never measured for performance was ascribable to that, and the resultant decision on your part to divvy up a straight $2.4 million between these people. I mean, you ended up with a big overrun. And it's a serious matter, and moreover, sir, I mean, I read that the CEO is suing you for defamation. So, I mean, the situation just becomes worse. Because I've now listened with care. You've said that new charges were added, and it was difficult to get the representatives in the case, the lawyers together, and to the question of dates. These are things that you have said before. But you are being sued for defamation inter alia because the lawyer of Ms. Muncher says emphatically that you are incorrect and defamatory when you say that lawyer kept playing for time by frequently being unavailable, when in fact it was because that it wasn't ready. And we've seen an opinion of your own legal advisor published in the last week or so, that also indicates that you didn't have a leg to stand on. Procedurally.
Here, the committee, didn't have a leg to stand on, please.
I'm asking for more information because the chairman has simply said what he said before. No, the lawyers weren't available and the dates didn't work out. But we now have the defamation action hanging. I mean, did ICASA defend the action of the CCMA, for example, in which Ms. Manche disputed the fact that there was a basis for her suspension? Did you even dispute that action? Because she was reinstated thereafter. And then, finally, can you now give us the facts? I mean, according to her lawyer, that agreement between you at the end that you've just referred to, the agreement was that there was no substance to the charges against her, and that there would be a joint media statement issued. And that would be the end of the matter. No further comment. But you have never would contradict an agreement.
On file in relation to all we want to establish was there were dilatory, they added new charges, the matter was not resolved. Now, we have to make our own conclusion as to whether, in fact, that's an efficient way of running an organization. Whether, in fact, they had a good case or not is up to them to do that. Right? And I think it's a fair conclusion to make. You have told us very clearly that there were additional charges brought. You've answered the chairperson, but you didn't pursue the original basis for the suspension. Right? You didn't pursue that. You added new charges. And it took 10, 11 months to do that. Now, we'll draw our own conclusions when we discuss this matter as to whether it's an efficient way of running it. Right? Now, next question, Mr. Tadeba.
Chairperson, quite a different question altogether. In respect of the multidisciplinary competencies that you referred to, engineering and technology, telecoms, etc., and you have said that you envisage that with the onset of the ECA, there will be many more of those competencies that you will have to deal with as an organization. Now the question is whether you think that there is sufficient self-financing mechanisms within the organization apart from the parliament request that you get in order to ensure that you keep your staff and more or less pay at the same level as the private sector, given the various competencies that you require of your councillors, etc.
It is indeed
a challenge for us as a council. We are under resourced financially, and we are not able to attract the right human resource capabilities. To a very, very great extent, that challenge will still remain for as long as we are under resourced. We, as a matter of fact, have come up with the game plan of activities that we have to be by way of projects that we've got to be involved in, and we have costed them. But the allocation that we got is far much less than the tasks in terms of our mandate that we have to fulfill. And that is one of the greatest challenges. Especially with the onset of the Electronic Communications Act, which has included 9 councillors as opposed to 7 before, as well as the posters, as well as making sure that we offer, shall I say, market-related salaries, is not happening. And I can say, lastly, a greater number of our staff have gone to operators, close to over 80%, if I were to be on the conservative side. So ICASA somehow has served as a training ground. I can point out an example of one person who was posed to go to one organization, and halfway that person was reposed before even reaching that organization, coming from ICASA. And that was a very, very resourceful person. So the value was seen in that person through committees that he was part of, and of course he was seen as a trophy. It's just an example of showing that we don't have the resources that we can in matching human resources that we need to regulate this industry.
How do you end the hemorrhage?
We can only end the hemorrhage by, first and foremost, having enough resources to retain staff, offer market-related salaries, and also create an environment that is conducive within ICASA for people to want to work for ICASA.
And we are making serious attempts to address the conducive environment that everybody is
in ICASA. But in as far as resources, financial and all that, we really are beholden to the people who finance us.
Excuse me, I have a cataract operation, so I can see your appendices are so small inside. It's very hard to read them, actually. But a very important post is a licensing officer. I would have thought. To be freed from corruption, from exception, from benefits. But the licensing officer is paid $264,000. An advisor, part-time, is paid $380,000. Now, you don't have the permission. You say market-related. For $208,000, now university lecturers are paid $208,000. Now, whose permission do you have to get to keep a licensing officer and pay only $280,000? It's a bit more now. It's gone up $289,000 now this year. So can you answer this question? You say market-related. Now, it is true that one of the great successes of the Star Revenue Service is that they are cut off. The civil service rules don't apply for salaries and grading and all. Whose permission do you have to say the next licensing officer, chief licensing officer, will pay her $700,000?
Thank you, Chair. I think we can answer the question in this fashion. With the ECA coming into effect, we've had to relook at our operations. And one of the projects that is currently underway is to review, firstly, people's job descriptions, and emanating therefrom will be a process of trying to benchmark the different positions within ICASA to gain an understanding of when we talk of market-related salaries for a certain position, how much are we talking about? And just to correct, the advisors are employed on a full-time basis. So,
the board advisor only gets
It's full time, yes. Yes, so once we've completed that exercise, we should gain an understanding, and that will also form part of the retention strategy that we need to develop.
3 years ago, the review by the government, the presidential review, said you are difficult to retain staff, you don't have a program for mentoring to keep staff, you don't have a program to insist how important your work is. You know, there are people. I knew as a minister, I had a PhD who was working in the forest section. He would have begged, he said, well, I love working in the public service. There is such a thing. That's provided the climate is okay. Providing you deal with a suspension within 3 months or 10 months, then you give a value system to them. Isn't that so? Now, you see, to pay a licensing officer $280,000 doesn't mean you have to wait for a huge project proposal, right? I thought licensing officers is a very important body.
Agreed, Chairperson, and that's why we are embarking on this exercise precisely to address some of the shortcomings.
Thanks, Jay. On the same issue of salaries, we received a submission from the Portfolio Committee on Communications, and in that submission they refer to the fact that there is what they call internal instability because of the high staff turnover. The report then goes further to say that in appointing the ICASA councillors, the issue of remuneration came up as a major source of concern, but it was subsequently attended to by the relevant ministry. So my sense from the report is that it's been resolved. Is that correct?
The councillor sitting here. Yes, it's been addressed at that level. But then the process that we're undertaking currently is to cascade it down to the level of staff.
Sure, I think the important point to note is that we came to Parliament last year, cap in hand, to make a representation through them to Treasury that additional resources would be required in the order of about 68 million to implement the ECA. There are no less than about 200 regulations that have to be regazetted, policy papers that need to be regazetted. There isn't even been so much of the publication budget allocated, the 750 rand a page of the government printers. So, you know, the laws are passed without any additional budgetary allocation outside of our annual increment. Some allocation was made for postal and for the additional two councillors. To address the question on councillor salaries, it may be worth noting that while they have been increased, they're still way below those of other regulators in our own sector. We're not even benchmarking against the market. There are no benefits that attach to that. But that notwithstanding, we have begun this process, as I think the CEO pointed out. How that is going to be funded still remains to be seen. Additional allocations have got to be made. Alternatively, the ability to fulfill the mandate is somewhat questioned and compromised.
My question is, has your organization actually done an internal survey to see whether you have overemployment in a certain area where you haven't got permanent staff, and whether in a certain area there's over payment on certain staff? Do you have job sharing? How do you allocate your jobs in your organization? Thank you.
I think as part of council reallocating its work plans, I mean, part of the exercise entailed looking at the resources that are there. And having done that, the matter is at a point where you're now trying to look at what work people are doing and what value do you attach to that work, so that you can have a remuneration strategy that is informed by the actual work that people have to do.
Thank you, Chairperson.
I would like to know as to what extent has over-reliance on international consultancies, if there's any, to what extent has had that an impact on the very problem of resources available to the organization? Has it affected you negatively? Is it something that happens more much more frequently? I would like you to answer this in relation to my first question.
I can simply say that we have a very dynamic center, I mean, sector, where knowledge is transitory. You know, you could have come out qualified 5 years ago, but 5 years later you're obsolete. So you need to have someone who's always current at any particular, with advances of technology and all kinds of things. Sometimes there are people whose task and role is to do specific things in life and not be encumbered by other things. And we do realize that from time to time, we have to call in experts who have got international experience, who have made references to other regulatory bodies, and we customize those needs to our environment. But from time to time, we also use consultants in South Africa, not necessarily international, where the need arises in terms of a skill base of the nature that I say is ever-changing. We do get consultants from outside the borders of South Africa. But we also insist in the process that there must be skilling attached to the consultants coming to help us with services. So there will be an attachment of an internal organization to be linked up with an external body so that the skills are tapped and are retained. And therefore, from time to time, we can depend on the person who has an understudy and then becomes a consultant. But as I say, given the sector as it is, we have difficulties in making sure that we are up to speed, up to date from time to time. We have to be constantly on the lookout as what the macro environment is asking for at any particular time. The issue about convergence of networks, convergence of services, is a new area. We have the DVB-H, DAB, and all of these technologies, WiMAX, you name them all. All of that needs someone who probably must have set in as an expert and can give us far much more detailed insights and understanding into how we have to go about. So, much as we would like to have all those people skilled in South Africa to do that, we make sure that consultants do help our internal companies to retain those skills as we pay those external consultants.
Ms. Swartz?
Just by way of leading in, yes, you must absolutely have access to all of the international experts you need, and the minister ought nothing to have nothing to do with it. Secondly, I think your salaries deserve to be very high, and Section 219 of the Constitution requires that you, precisely you and judges and other commissioners of independent bodies, ought to be dealt with separately, which you are not yet. And I personally support the idea of... I personally am in favour of cost recovery for you and a huge budget for CASA, you know all of those things. But now, having said that, I think with respect that it is not so, that it is entirely poaching by industry that accounts for the loss of your entire general management. You have lost all of your general managers, not that. All of them. You have lost further senior staff. That's quite apart from the business with the CEO and the other business with the CFO, who is under police investigation. The CEO is not, in my opinion. Now, you've lost all these people. It is a... That has got to be a terrible reflection, and you do need to answer to us what it is about the way you're running ICASA that is problematic. Because, as Councillor Mashile and the other councillors know, people have been required to write exit reports. The council itself gave these exit reports to an independent consultant, and some of the factors identified are as follows. But there are empires within the council.
The question, what is it resulted in these pathologies.
Is it not empires? Is it not
the please, they answer the question. I think the Orientals have a capacity to ask question and reply to it already. Ask the question, what are the pathologies resulted in this effective breakdown?
Let me answer in a precise manner. All of those general managers that left went for, most of them, went for greener pastures. We can bring a list of where they went to. They opened up their own BE companies. And you remember that we are in an environment where companies have got to fulfill the GE requirements. And sometimes, stuff that is black is really in demand. And there are very, very few professionals. Therefore, the market forces are at play to post them from wherever they are. By and large, most of them had served sufficient enough time to have gained knowledge and experience and understanding to move on. If I were to give you a list of all the individual councillors, you'll realize that they are having a better, greener pasture than they could have had in Icasa with regard to remuneration. That one, I'm not to say that it's an excuse, but it's one of the key factors. As I pointed out, we had one person, I'm sure it does not need repeating, to say that person went for a higher salary, found himself on his way, rerouted for a far much more higher salary. And I can also identify all other individuals who formed their own company. Some of the general managers formed their own companies. And therefore they saw the opportunity that they can come back and become operators in this environment. Others went to the operators. I can identify people at Telkom, Vodacom, etc., who were with us, who were very key people, who were doing a good job. But they have moved to those organizations. I don't deny the ability that may arise, but I'm just also mitigating some of the factors that can indicate where did this person go to. And you will realize that they were sought after in industry, and they went to...
Mr. Messina, I think we must move on. I think the answer is, but the fact is, it still affects your credibility. Because you don't understand the market, it's a major issue about your credibility. It is. If in fact it worked out in 2003, but you might, if you're qualified staff have been pushed, then you work on a smaller group of professional staff, much highly paid, better paid, you will retain them. The question I would ask you, which we move on, is what public pressure have you generated to ensure, like SARS? SARS doesn't lose staff. The revenue service doesn't lose staff. Look at them. What public pressure have you generated in 3 years? At the portfolio committee, in your meetings with the president, in the meetings with the Minister of Finance, communications, but we'll have a much more streamlined staff. Much more streamlined staff, technically very proficient, and I don't know what the market rate is, but that's you to work on. But we will, in fact, employ them like SARS does. Have you, don't tell me you're starting the exercise now, but did you start 3 years ago to say, smaller staff, much more competent, and we'll keep them, and we'll clearly work out a division, but the commissioners will not interfere in the day-to-day activities. Give them self-respect. Have you worked that out yet?
I think we all are aware that ICASA, in its formation, was a result of the coming to being of IBA and SADRA. And that in itself, of course, leaves us with a legacy. And sometimes it's not so easy to go into an exercise of retrenchment, much as you may want to trim and slim. There are sensitivities with regard to the individuals who have been employed and then told to move on because ICASA is restructuring. That sensitive part can visit us with far much more untold difficulties that we may not even be able to handle. Given the situation of, I don't want to say we are sensitive to the fact that people are unemployed and therefore we do not want to create unemployment. But I'm just saying that the sensitive nature of really trimming and slimming has got to be handled with care and caution.
much as the organization would like to say, we want to keep as few people as possible and pay them high. That may be an ideal that we may want to strive.
You have enormous influence, anti-competitive behavior, regulation. The liquidator in this company, I can't say anymore, just there's 200 staff yesterday, legally necessary. Now, I think you have to work this out. You have enormous political power, real important. Also, public service power about anti-competitive behavior, for which you need technical people. You know, social security outfits, right? Government departments are social security outfits, the regulatory body. However, that's for the commission. Can we move on to your, because your relationship with other bodies? Yeah.
One last question on institutional governance, because I think it's not a subject I've ever or we've ever discussed before. Have you ever considered the matter of the fact that you each have an advisor and a PA? It's quite interesting to see it in tabulated form. So my understanding is it correct that it comes from the old IBA, former organization? But do you not think that there's a difficulty? This is an informed question, I don't have to tell you that. Don't you think there's a difficulty? You have highly specialized general managers and senior managers working on the regulatory work, highly skilled work. Some are technological, some telecom, some broadcasting, some legal. Now, when those people have worked through, sometimes with, not always with a counselor, a recommendation, and it goes to a counsellor, but the counsellor tends to work with the advisor, will sometimes take the advisor's view. Is that not part of the structural difficulty at ICASA? And why should you and no other comparable commission have advisors? The Constitutional Court is the only other place I can
think of. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I think we didn't actually have a look at that and thought that it probably is a historical, as you pointed out, dating back from the IBA days, because probably at that time there was not sufficiently resource people to help with the day-to-day activities of licensing and all that. But realizing now that the general managers are actually our advisors because they bring recommendations to us, we have thought about it, that these people could be redeployed somewhere to serve a far much more greater service than to be an individual counselor's advisor.
Does the Kakane as an advisor, is it the same Kakane as a member of parliament? That's an answer. Please, Ms. Mutz, we're trying to clarify that. Ms. Mutz, please, let's have some order. But you pay an advisor, they're on contract or permanent?
They're on contract, tax to the council.
Thank you. During the duration of the council. Well, that's good.
Can you move on, because
it's
so exciting here, if you have any information on the bodies. You have relations with other bodies, you say? You take an account what other bodies take from their own body. Can you tell us what relations you have to their own body?
I think I will ask the Councillor Van Rooyen to come with one piece of information he could bring on board with regard to other bodies, and then of course we will come through this route for the various organizations that we have relationships with.
Chairperson, yes, I've looked carefully at the Chapter 9 institutions in advising the chairperson, and it is clear that we have a unique situation. What our relation is, of course, we all have a Bill of Rights as a basis, but each one could argue on the Gender Commission vis-a-vis some other commission like the Human Rights Commission, so, but this is the body which really has a legislative function, a judicial function, and an administrative function, and a licensing function, and a policy-making function. It's unique. If you compare it to the Human Rights Commission, for example, which does not have a sanction authority at all, it only recommends, we decide. So that's the background. Secondly, of course, it will be useful to have this kind of contact, and I think regularly councillors would do speeches and at human rights occasions. We've also now, Councillor Masiza is really involved and the World Summit as to Children. That has a general application and we've also spent some money in that regard. So basically I think it's a good relationship, and but that doesn't take away the fact that we have a unique function.
It's also unique. You say broadcasting complaints are sent to the Broadcasting Complaints Commission. You do have a relationship with somebody else.
You're asking the... It's tricky for me, but our position is that in accordance with the ruling which was made in 1995 by the IBA, which still stands today, that the National Association of Broadcasters has set up its own disciplinary body, and this accords with what the ASA does on advertising. This also accords with what the Press Council, the Press Ombudsman does, and it's I would say that generally the relationship is one of working together insofar as is necessary. That the task of the CCC, which one has now, in terms of the present legislation, is so much wider than that in the past. We've just set them up. They'll be appointed from the 1st of March, and a chairperson has been also appointed by us. The letters will be going out this week. Just on that point is that the functions are wide.
The Complaints Commission. But tell the members of the committee about that, because...
The Broadcasting Complaints Commission is...
No, your own commission, the CCC.
Yes, the CCC, how it functions? Well, it'll act on complaints, or matters will be referred to it by the council. You can even now be asked to give legal advice. There's one instance where the council could refer a matter of interconnection to it for resolution, which would not go to the council. Basically, a complaint comes to the CCC. The CCC decides on the merits. Then it advises council as to the sanction, and therefore council will then take a decision. So in most 99%, the sanction lies with the council.
Why is it that this is the one commission that the most litigated of all, the most complaints, most cases, and mostly by Telkom South Africa, by the way, right? Why is it not possible to work out a structure where many of the proposals for your proposals have been long drawn out, because the courts take 2 or 3 years, we've lost the basis for very good decision, and there's a great amount of money involved in it. Is it not possible to have some machinery for arbitration? Rather than going to courts of law.
Yeah.
And that's very important for our own, your efficacy of your work.
The
Commission may not know the committee, and this is the most litigated body when it comes to, you know why it's litigated? Where there's money, where there's muck, there's money. Where there's money, there's litigation. There's no litigation in relation to public protector and all that.
It's litigated like the, I must say, the National Transport Commission in the old days used to be the most litigated body. On the CCC front and the old BMCC, there was one dragging on case. It's only one case which deals with the functions of the BMCC as it then was. It's still dragging even on now. The Islamic Unity Convention is taking the whole structure which was set up by Parliament in those days, that the BMCC would have an inquiring function and that would interfere with its judicial function. And they're taking that to court to have those specific provisions put in by Parliament set aside as unconstitutional. Fortunately, the present ICASA Act does not have this inquiring function by the CCC. It will be independent. It will have an independent chair as well, who's an experienced lawyer, and there will be an administrative officer appointed to see whether there's a prima facie case to make sure that this litigation, which is, insofar as the BMCC is concerned, is a one-time litigation. It's one case which has been dragging on. It's a Broadcasting Monitoring and Complaints Committee. I'm sorry, it's the predecessor of the CCC, Chairperson.
Not the Islamic Unity Club. I'm talking about issues involving Telkom and other commercial companies who drag out litigation against you. Why is it then so much litigation against you? Right? That's a question.
Chairperson, the answer really lies in the fact that big money at stake here. And if one looks, just take the Radio Pretoria saga itself. They've lost all cases against us over the last 5 years. And it's not us who start those cases, they start the cases. And they've lost the cases, Chair.
There ought to be some arrangements where other business people go to arbitration. Arbitration is decided very quickly. Very quickly. If it needs legal recourse, legal change, that's going to happen. All I'm saying here is a huge amount of public money and resources and opportunities are lost.
Chairperson, might I just say that if we can work that into the Act, it will be fantastic. But it's not in the Act, therefore they take the ordinary course and take us on review.
But you should say that in the next annual report to Parliament, shouldn't you? You shouldn't have the chairman of the ad hoc committee making a recommendation to you now. Yes, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think the concern that Professor Karasmal that you're raising is a concern that has been noted, and that the Portfolio Committee, when amending, well, when coming up with the ECA Act, took cognizance of. That is why we now have a provision in the ECA Act that specifically states that a decision of the authority will be valid and binding until set aside by a court of law, so that you actually have the decision valid, binding, and enforceable until such time as they're set aside by a court of law. This prevents against the situation whereby operators actually take the regulator to court, keep us in court for many years, so that the decisions that we make are not of any force in effect. So that has been factored in the new legislation.
An incident, possibly. Part of the answer is only. Well, you can get the ticket. I'm getting around slowly, yes? I am, yes. I'm not missing anybody. Yes.
Chair, thank you. I mean, I think it's the nature of the interest. I'm sitting here smiling because I'd like to imagine a situation in which we sit down and arbitrate the situation in pricing with the mobile operators. It's the nature of the interest. The visit to the FCC earlier, towards the end of last year, confirmed that I think almost none of the substantive decisions have gone unchallenged. This is unavoidable. But can I, Chair, if you'll allow me, the nature of your question originally was the relationship with other Chapter 9 bodies, and various other acronyms have come up. And I think just conceptually, if we can distinguish between our relationship with other Chapter 9s, for which Councillor van Rooyen has pointed out there is no overlap outside of shared values, then there's the self-regulatory bodies such as the BCCSA and the NAB, that have industry bodies that have come about, and then other regulatory bodies with whom we do have a relationship, such as the Competition Commission and the Tribunal, which is governed by a memorandum of understanding. So there are different relationships in respect of the different bodies. And then the nature of the cases that come out of them are the broadcasting cases are content-related and linked to license conditions. The telecoms litigation that you're referring to is invariably around pricing, price caps, that sort of thing.
Stop the courts holding up things. We come to the finances, the heart of it, things like that. You make a very important recommendation, and that is that you should have some authority to keep part of the fees for funding. Obviously, you can't do it entirely autonomously, because you have to be accountable to someone as to what. But you also mentioned that the fees may fall in 1 year. So how seriously have you pursued this idea? Because let me just share with you, it's quite clear that Parliament will have to play a central role in the budgets of bodies. Not because we want to. It's in a general consensus on that. Right? So the Parliament has got its own act together and got its own budget. What's the process? Tell us, because we asked us, how do you establish your budget from the beginning, in August this year? You'll have a discussion on the petition. Presumably, you include the chief executive officer and the finance officer, when you can find them, you will get them in there. Presumably, you consult the staff, the managers, presumably each area. So you've got your apostolic succession worked out. What happens next?
Okay, what happens, Chair, is that different business units will each look at their respective MTF priorities. No, before it gets there. Then, once they are developed, they get sent up to council to look at with a view to see is this consistent with our vision for the next. Yes. Yes.
The council now resolved that we want 560
meters. Yes.
What happened next?
It's a question of prioritizing. Is everything that. Yes. Yes. Yes.
I think what happens is that when we have finalized the budget, we then take that budget to the DOC, who then in turn would have to take it to the Department of Communications, who in turn then takes it to Treasury.
What happens if you have a budget, you want to sign it for certain treats, and you send it to the Department of Communication. Who do you send it to? The minister or the deputy?
On matters relating to finances, we interact with the DG right. And the CFO.
And the Director General speaks to the principal? No?
No.
What is the Director General? That's what it
is. I think there is a link between us and National Treasury. But there are ongoing discussions at that level to see whether is it consistent with the.
I think what the chief and the person wants to know, if I might be so bold, is the Department of Communications merely your post box, or do they negotiate on your behalf at Treasury?
Well, they are part of the discussion with National Treasury.
But ultimately, National Treasury takes the decision on the allocation.
They play God and we are only fully prophets in a way. You know, sometimes that much authority. No. What we want to know, because this is central to us for independence, is you work out your own arrangements. Right? Yeah. 4 extra items only, but you have subheadings, you can make it 12, by the way, isn't that right? And the Treasury says no to that. So it's sent to the DOC, the communication. The communications people then arrange a meeting with Treasury where they invite you. That's what we want to know. That's quite different from saying we interact with Treasury as it's for us, right? They invite you to come. And then what happens at that meeting?
Then basically you present your business plan and your budgetary needs. And obviously there will be debating and Councillor Masiza.
Chair, I think in the one meeting that we attended, we went with the CEO and we actually met with the whole group of people from Treasury. We were told how much was available for distribution across all government departments. So there was no way that we could then argue, you know, for the allocation that we're looking for. But we're simply told that this is the amount that is available and you have to live within those means.
So they may say that
if Parliament deals with that, first you could say that this is the amount available across 5.5%. How Parliament decides to do that between Chapter 9 bodies is up to Parliament. So we clarify that. Now, that's only once you met the Treasury Committee. Only once.
Chairperson, would it be correct, therefore, to conclude that the occurrence of these meetings between yourselves, Department of Communications and National Treasury are a mere formality, and whatever you're going to get is fair and complete. Correct?
See, he talks in better here to fair and complete.
It's not always a fait accompli, because in certain instances you can convince them to increase whatever allocation. It has happened before that we were able to convince them.
One of our term of reference is funding to licensing and all that. And that was put in by the Treasury specifically in relation to you. But is it possible for your funding to come? You know, the Treasury had a lot to do with that term of reference. You get income from licensing and all. So we're not inviting you. All I asked you was, have you taken this up? But some of the money could be kept with the Portfolio Committee, with the Treasury. We want to know that. What is the folk memory in this? Because that's one of the things. What's the institutional memory? Can you tell us, Mr. Westerner? What's the institutional memory? How long does it last?
4 or 5 years.
No,
sir. Well, I mean,
Advocate von Rohan is 2 months.
2 months, right.
My friend here, Sunu.
Five months. It's 3 years. With me, 3 years and 2 years.
The next one? The acting chief executive?
I think 7 years.
My sister?
5 years.
Chief, I think it's 3 years towards the end of my term.
Yeah. Miss Cohen?
Term comes from a season.
Sorry?
It's the same, almost 3 years.
3 years, right.
4 months, Chief.
1 year, 7 months almost.
So there is, in fact, you've only met the Treasury people once.
Remember, the interaction will be at the level of the CEO, and perhaps in certain instances, Council will delegate one amongst itself to accompany the CEO and the CFO.
Have you taken this up about some of the licensing money? It's a very important condition in this. You want to run with this, we want to see how realistic it is. Have you made any suggestions publicly?
The suggestions have been made before, and it never found its way to the recent amendments to the ICASA Act, but there has been ongoing interaction, at least in that respect.
We have made submissions even in the ICASA amendment process. We have made submissions to the department itself directly, even to the ministry. So this is not a new submission. It has been repeated time and time again. Unfortunately, it has not been taken on board. I think largely because there have been concerns about the accounting mechanism that would then be put in place. That has been the real concern, but it has been raised.
It's not self-evident. That's what I've been dealing with it. What happens if, in fact, your income from licensing is very small for 1 year? How do you meet the difference now? No, all we want to know is, if you have made this and if you have thought about it, and now that I'm inviting you, could we have a document from you which answers all these questions? What happens if you fall back 1 year? What about accountability? What about who's going to be responsible for what? And what about being careful that you don't give too many licenses to increase your, augment your income?
May we ask you to include there in some comparative work, such as, for example, the United Kingdom's Communications Act, because I think that will strengthen the case. It is, in fact, a very old issue, Chair, between Parliament, been dealt with in Parliament. The reason why there is a clause now in the ICASA Amendment Act saying that the Minister, together with the Minister of Finance, can also channel other monies is precisely because of this issue. It made its way into the first draft, magically, of an ICASA Amendment Act. But it then went away again. What is there? And that's why the Treasury is waiting, I think, for our recommendation on an old issue. I wanted to ask you, what were we talking about before, Chair? It was important. It was important, but we've now. No. This issue arose in the midst of other.
Yeah.
Well, I've lost my chance, haven't I?
Very important issue. The allocation of benefits, by whether it is by the people who are the full-time officials, by you, has enormous economic influence and power. Disclosure of interests. Right? Where do the councillors make disclosure of interests? Who is the repository? What do they disclose? Are they allowed because you are paid full time? You are paid 3 times as much as a professor in the university. It's paid, by the way, so it's not too bad, really. They work very hard, the professors in the university, too. Now, do you have outside interests? Whose permission do you have to seek to have outside interests? Secondly, if you're a director of another company. Secondly, who keeps your disclosure of interests? And when, because you see, remember, you are allocating benefits which sometimes, I mean, look at the cellular telephones. They paid 100 million. They're now worth 70 billion. Their turnover is now, right? And they paid 100 million for licensing here. Now, who keeps this? Now, first of all, who gives consent for outside to staff and the councillors? Can you take this down? Consent, staff, and councillors. Secondly, where is the disclosure made? Who keeps the disclosure list? How often is it brought up today? Fine question. We just want answers. Oh yes, Esther, you have a public and a confidential part of the register. How come? And who looks at the confidential part of the register? You see, I invented that in 1996 for parliamentarians, but it's open to all the commissions, the disclosure of interest committee, right, on which number of people have served here. It's open to them. Anybody can complain, it's open to you, right? So it's not entirely confidential, it's open to the committee.
With respect to interests that are held by councillors, we have a code of conduct for councillors, and that code of conduct specifies as to the manner by which each councillor is expected to disclose their interests, and it specifies the manner and the nature of interests that are to be disclosed. Directorships within an operator within either the the communications, broadcasting and postal sector is prohibited and is not permitted in terms of the code of conduct. With regard to staff, initially we did not have a specific code or process by which staff were expected to disclose their interests, but now we have extended the code of conduct to apply to staff and the specific procedures by which they are expected to disclose their interests in relation to directorships in specific companies. With respect to who we make the disclosures to, the register is kept by the CEO, and all disclosures are forwarded to the CEO, and you are expected to update your declaration as and when you know there is a need, but annually that the disclosure is expected to be updated.
Needs to modernize because
of the last issue. There's no publishing section of the declarations. All declarations are published in their nature.
This is what it says here. Sorry, words for me graven in my bosom. That's a dead part. I'll ask supplementary. That's a dead part.
Short question: do you cover only directorships or interests? Because you mentioned only directorships.
All interests and gifts that are received from the sector at any given time have to be disclosed.
The real problem is, you see, it applies. You see, ours is a public domain. It casts a publisher, it does a publisher's
once a year. They lost interest now, but they used to before. It's in the public domain. When it comes to judges now, censor. If it's kept by the chief executive officer, who's it accessible to? What's the point of keeping the register, which is like a Catholic confessional, confidential? Yeah, please, can you help us? Because we're going to make it in the terms of reference.
I guess it's available on request, because the idea was never. I take your point when you say it has to be publicly available. Maybe it's something that we need to take back and consider making it publicly available.
One of the things which we will discuss is whether in annual report every year we should mention the external interests of members. I've got up to date every year, it's one page. But what we can do in annual reports is leave out the pictures of the board, of the councillors, leave out the pictures of the chief executive officer, chief financial officer, and include then disclosure of interest. Other. That should be the annual report.
We've also developed any interest. So all the more reason for making it that I'm showing that there is examples. I mean, there are conflicts in between. It's a huge, difficult area. So much so, I mean, we had to start writing sort of into laws, and nobody may lurk behind the pot plant with a cell phone. I mean, things got so wild with some of the licensing procedures.
Yeah. Interests are not only included in the communications area, or now in the post office, but includes the wider things too. I mean, look at the post office. You can have all kinds of interests related to the post office, but at least we should know. In this area, which mercifully has been free of corruption, that it could continue. Free of corruption, at least to my knowledge. Now,
is there any other questions from the committee which we haven't touched on? We touched on all of which will be important, 25 of them.
It's substantial that it was to happen. I mean, some of the questions are repetitive. The eight or five or six questions are repetitive. But if they're left out, we must, Ms. Johnson, is there a passionate urge that we should let at question number 14, for example? But can I say then? Yes.
Okay. I just would like to know, with regard to complaints by members of the public, with regard to the cost of telephony, right, mobile or fixed line, in practical terms, how do you deal with that? I think it's still a problem today. I think the President has, in the State of the Nation address, I think of 2005, referred to this. But are you quite certain that members of the public are aware that they could, for instance, lodge these complaints, say, with you or whoever, with regard to that, and how do you deal with them?
I think the first issue that we have to raise is that because of the lack of funding, we have not been able, for instance, to come up with an 086 or 0800 number so that members of the public can phone that number. Also, we have not been able to establish offices in the respective provinces, so we actually get closer to the members of the public. We currently only have offices in five areas. And specifically, we are servicing the Northern Cape, for instance, from the Bloemfontein office. So it, because of those restricted resources, we cannot really be everywhere, which we are trying to address in terms of this financial year going forward. But in terms of those that are lucky, because I would actually say they are lucky, we try and resolve those disputes within 3 days to 14 days maximum period in terms of addressing those issues. But then again, that's really not the norm that we want to aspire to, want to reduce that number.
You mean 3 to 5 days? That's fantastic. I mean, which other body that appeared before us completes his work within 3 months? Good. Now, let me just say, one of the unintended implications of setting up regional offices is the costing of that. The one thing we have found is that bodies love regional offices, but haven't actually worked out how much it costs, really. And the supervision of regional offices. So if, I mean, we can't tell you what to do. If rather that we have a well-publicized ICASA, a leaflet in every post office, every social welfare office, and things like that, rather than regional offices, but by the way. Thank you. Yes.
I guess almost every community in South Africa, and one could say perhaps sometimes women's groups, youth, etc., would like to have a community registration. I have personal experience of people in various communities who, without proper information as to what it is that they have to do to ensure that they are granted a license. You've referred to constraints as far as resources are concerned, but what within the limits of your current resources are you doing to ensure that these people have information, and if they want to make such an application, then they can do that?
Through your chair, I think what we're trying, we have outreach programs that we do. For instance, we target each province per month. We try to revisit each province, where we go with across the board in terms of the services, telecommunication services, broadcasting, and postal. We then try and deal with those issues that arise in that specific area. But we also get some other additional requests from the members of the public. For instance, they'll start asking something around agriculture and what has to be done with the toilets. So it's still a way that we're trying to deal with. For instance, in some of the areas that we visit, we normally also take the electricity regulator with ourselves, because we cannot talk about communications and broadcasting if there's no electricity. So there's no point in ICASA only going there as ICASA. We have to go with all the other regulators that are really connected to what we're trying to talk about, to all those. So we do have those outreach programs.
One thing which I think might assist us, because as the chairman, there are whole areas we haven't touched or exhausted. But let me ask you this, it helps us. I don't think we should start on the what the chairman felt on the PMFA and the role of the CEO. That wants a lot of discussion, but not perhaps now. But may I ask you this on the appointment mechanism? Because it's something that interests us very much as a committee. It's obviously very salient to independence. You will recall that in the ICASA Amendment Act now, we introduced a new thing, which was the fact that 5 technical experts could be invited by the relevant parliamentary committee to sit with them in the interviewing and the eventual choice of 8 of the names, from which the minister would then choose 5. That was a kind of a compromise position based on the IEC model, where a pre-legislated panel, the Chief of the Constitutional Court, certain other persons, do all the public invitation, interviewing, and the recommendation of the list to Parliament in that case. This was another version of it by compromise. In the event, when it came to the interviewing and choosing of some of your own good selves, the majority of the members in that committee simply declined to appoint the technical experts. It was, unfortunately, not a peremptory part of the session, but a permissive one. And I would like to ask you now you've all come through the process very well, of course, so, but when you need to fill vacancies in future, when we need to fill the vacancies for you, would you consider it a good idea to have introduced into the appointment process by Parliament such an outside panel, whether before Parliament sees them or during the parliamentary process? It's a very important question.
I don't think I can ask that. That's a policy issue. The commissioners here, they have no common view on it. No, there's no common view on this. There cannot be a common view. You can ask individuals, but I didn't allow last time the questions about individuals, because they're here as a commission, and they speak. And it's a policy matter for Parliament. Is there any other relevant question that you're dying to ask, which is relevant to the work of this committee? Right?
No.
Might I just say something which I think...
You can't.
The press was present and there was reference to this defamation case against...
You can't. You can do it through the chairman, yeah.
Yeah, I'm asking the chairman for permission to...
with a kind...
I'm not speaking, but I think we need to get the press. The chairman was decided, and I think we need to just clarify that.
Clarify what? What issue?
There was a reference to a defamation case against Picasso earlier by Honourable Mingus Smuts. I might just want to clarify that, because I've been also looking at the situation. The answer at the moment is that it has been warded off, the whole matter. I must also mention, though, that although they claim this, there is never an agreement by Picasso that the charges were without any foundation.
Out of order. Really out of order. We are not sitting here in judgment of a specific issue. We are having an oversight of great respect. Our job is oversight. Are you doing the work you're supposed to be doing? The matter of principle there was 10 months delay. Right? That's a matter of principle. That affects the efficacy. How you arrive at that is your business. Right? The commission's business. And what happens in a court of law is your own business.
But Chair, will you allow me, because the press was present and it was left in the air, and that's, I think, there's a duty upon me as one of the lawyers to say that we've warded off the matter. I think it's important.
No, of course you can. No, but it's out of order. That the whole question seems a question out of order, frankly. That kind of minor issue arising as to what your case was is irrelevant to our hearing. And I must persuade my own committee about saying those things, right? Because you are not in the dock. Now, the press would report, I mean, they reported me to say that ANC aligned the commissions, as he reported again yesterday. I never said it. So I have news for you. You can withdraw and retract and all that. They will report whether you want to report, right? So I'm sorry about that. If they have been here and they left, they will blast the commission and ascribe things to you that should have never arisen before this commission. Can I thank you very much? What we are concerned about, frankly, because of importance, is the institutional design of the agency. That's what we're concerned about. Adequate resourcing, skills development, are central issues. The efficiency of the council, that's our job. It's legitimacy. That's what we're looking at too. The political will to create an accountable, independent regulator where the sector respects you. That's another aspect too, because that's what some of the reference are used, performing your function in a developmental state. And the sector must respect you. And the most clear statement is an efficient, functional, effective regulatory framework. That's what we're asking. So all the details were in the general context of that sentence. It's been a tough session. Right? Thank you very much. We may have to call you back, by the way. Right? When we may call you back, is because these are open sessions. The committee has reserved the rights to have those sessions also. Obviously, right? But this is the main line entrance to this. We may have to call you back, but of course, you know, I see your body language shows that you might like to come back. I thought your body language would have been very different, Ms. Gowan. So, we may have to call you back, but thank you very much, members of the committee, and we'll see you on Friday when we listen to the first NGOs here on Friday. Our discussion NGO. Thank you very much. I declare this session closed. Let's say, Edna, come here. Let's work it out. My head is going down. I'll make it a special.
unless we have the press. We've never talked to her, this woman.
I'm going to go to the next one.